I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome along to another episode of Le French Rugby Podcast with me, Tim Groves, ex-Scotland international Johnny Beattie and former France international Benjamin Kayser. The big guests just keep coming, don't they? So we won't keep you in suspense too long before revealing who we've got on the show this week, but we're at least a little bit interested in what you guys have been up to as well. So how you been?
Good. After watching some fairly incredible games at the weekend, I managed to get on a train up to Paris for a cool event. Called Cannes à Table, which was pretty cool. So drinking wine and schmoozing around with Lionel Nalle, Sebastian Chabal, some of your old friends, Benji, Cedric Haymans, Julien Bonner. So it was great fun.
It was unreal just to get European rugby back on the table. I mean, I'm a huge, huge fan of European rugby. That's what I've always sort of lived for. So I'm desperate to see it back. Very, very random to see Semi Radradra playing for Bristol, to see and just running through people like they were nothing. Very random to see 5,000 crowds or to see no crowd at all. But it was still European rugby, so I was still chuffed. I went to Toulon, and I was lucky enough to do Toulon-Scarlets, which was a great game. Scarlets gave them a proper run for their money. And I had a few wines, but not with Sébastien Chabal and Lionel Nalle, just with my old mates Ice Toyava and Chris Massoi, who apparently had a double up then the massive
weekend. He was with me again.
So he had a great time. But with a funny, funny story of what happens in the hotel room afterwards, but I'll keep it for later.
Oof. Ooh, intriguing. Let's touch on those European quarterfinals then, because it was a good weekend for the French clubs, apart from Cast, but we'll get onto them in a minute. But one of them lost, Clermont. Benji, what happened?
We told you last week. I mean, we were scared. Yeah, me and Johnny were saying that, listen, Racing were hot. Clermont just felt that they were in doubt, you know, not themselves, not fully there yet. Franck Azema said it after the game. I think that quarterfinal came too early for this group. They're just not there yet. And to be fair, there's a turning point of 14 points consecutively scored by Racing, which are a little bit lucky, if you know what I mean. There's a kickoff. Damien Penaud jumps over everyone, whacks it. I think it's Juan Mimov picks it up and then he goes and score. Fantastic. And then there's that kick of that little bit lucky of François Trinduc, you know, the bounce. Matsushima's looking at the ball and it just bounces above his head, picks it up and scores again. And that's back-to-back 14 points, done deal. It shouldn't hide the fact that they got really pushed in the scrum. They really struggled in the scrum with a young tight head, Colombe, for Racing, who really made an impression on me. They got bullied, to be fair. So a bit of a reaction at the end with a few tries scored from Clermont, which is good, but it's worrying. It's a big disappointment. I think the boys were really, really bitter. Now it's going to be every week. Should have they started Sébastien Bézy instead of Morgan Power, blah, blah, blah. I think it's much bigger than that. I think it's just that they need to find their inner self before they decide to see how good they can be. There's definitely the quality. There's definitely the setup. It's just that at the moment, they seem a little bit soulless. And that's what worries me the most, because it's what hurts me the most.
In terms of body language and the way they're walking around the pitch, like you touched on the two easy Racing tries, but the first try that Racing scored, which was a maul going nowhere, and then a try in the corner, nobody even gets a hat. Like the easiest try I think I've ever seen scored freakishly in Clermont. And I just thought, what is going on? This isn't right. This isn't the Clermont that I have watched or known for 10, 15, 20 years. And I'm finding it really bizarre watching. And you've touched on the quality, the coaching team, the head coach, Franck Azema, hasn't really changed. the personnel hasn't changed. You've still got Parra, you've still got Lopez. All these guys are still leading, but they look lost. And I'm struggling to put my finger on it. Again, line-out percentage, they've got no platform. Their scrum got bullied. You know a lot of the boys in the camp. Is there anything, like, can you put your finger on anything that's changed or something that's missing or a lack of something? What for you has changed?
I know where you're going, and I think you're right. Franck Azema has been head coach, or at least in the coaching setup, for 11 years, I think it is. So he was 3 years backs coach with Vern Cotter. Then he became head coach. 3 years with John Gibbs, an extraordinary technician. Then 3 years with Bernard Gutta, and that's his second one. So yeah, what did I say? That's 10 years. Last year, 2 years ago, when I re-signed for 2 years and he re-signed his contract, we had those chats because that's the relationship him and I had, a very upfront and very sort of hand in hand. And I was like, are you not scared of sort of losing, you know, your authority over the group? Because you only have a certain amount of period where you can actually be really effective. And he says that mortifies me. He was really, really scared of thinking, my time has passed. It doesn't take anything away from the good dude that he is or the fantastic technician or manager. It's just that, you know, when you keep on hearing the same voice that sort of nags you to push that extra edge, then you're not going to want to go to 120%. You're just going to stick to 95, 100. But top level rugby is about pushing yourself that extra edge all the time. So he tried to do a new setup where he took some height. He became sort of the director of rugby that you guys know. And in France, it's very much forwards coach, backs coach, Laurent Travers, Laurent Labitte, that's it. Then the others are assistant coaches. Whereas in England, you sort of have that hierarchy, you know, with director of rugby and stuff. And the manager in France, for instance, the manager is almost takes care of the team kits and the flights and the bus rides. That's it. So Franck created a role where he is manager, director of rugby, however you want to call it, almost not on the field anymore, promoted Xavier Sadourny to come in there. And so the question is it enough? Is it enough to refreshen that chat, that speech, that authority? Clearly at the moment it isn't. And he mentioned it. Remember we spoke about the game in Bayonne? He said after the game that Bayonne were more hungry than them. And if a team is more hungry than you after 2 weeks, then I'm seriously worried. So he's put his finger on it. They're not hungry enough.
Franck Azema has created this English style system. Do you think that would have worked if he'd brought an outside voice in as a head coach underneath him? Would that have worked better?
I think, to be fair, I think he looked for one, but he didn't want to sign anybody just for the sake of it. He's got one thing with his coaching staff at the moment. Bernard Gutta, they played together in Perpignan. Didier Bess, they've known each other for 10 years. Gavis Adourny, he's the one that brought him up. So they've got this unity, which is very rare. And you ask Johnny, I mean, the best example is Mike Ford rocking up to Toulon. Yeah, I'm just a backs coach. 2 weeks later, he was already stabbing somebody in the back and he became head coach. At least that's never going to happen in Clermont. They've got a tight unit and none of them want his head. They're in this together. And that was his way of addressing it. And so John O'Gibbs, like I said, I touched on it, that he was an extraordinary technician. And so he looked for the other John O'Gibbs. How can I get somebody else who'll be like a number one just under me, who can really challenge me, bring a new voice? He loves the Southern Hemisphere attitude. So his idea, his strategy was to say, I'll create this little setup. I'll promote some of the guys, but I will get some outstanding consultants. Like Joe Schmidt came for three weeks in Clermont. They've got a really tight relationship with the AB setup. So when I was there, Ian Foster came for a week. Mike Cron, you know, the forwards coach, came for a week. To be fair, a week is not enough. No. So now they decide to get those guys for 3 weeks. We're waiting on the results.
I think the system's a great idea. It's the way it works in other countries. But the difference is, in France, you're forced almost to a certain extent, bring in friends, people that you can trust and work with that aren't going to push or contest too hard. And maybe that, from an outside perspective, the coaches that you've talked about aren't really that well known. So my consideration would be, maybe for Franck Azema, he has to get back closer to the pitch and take more control. Maybe the assistants that he's appointed aren't the quality that are really required to push on this team that has Parra, Lopez, Fofana, Benoît, like some of the best players in France that should be dominating and at the minute are not firing. So again, from an outside perspective, I would say to Franck Azema, you know, you need to get back on that training pitch.
But then you're back on square one. You're back to where you were. And he was trying to create this other thing, but it's not working at the moment. You're right.
It's better than where they are now, surely. Yeah. Anyway.
And that's to take nothing away from Racing, because they are in some good form at the moment. And we'll come to what we think of them in the semi-final potentially later on. But that game was at least competitive. We did suggest that it might not be in Toulouse, but they ran away with it against Ulster, didn't they?
They were unbelievable. I think as well that Ulster team, with a few injuries and a lack of depth that really showed through, and that they got blitzed. I mean, they got absolutely the strength, the power, the pace, the offloads. I mean, everything that you want to see from a Toulouse team, they did. And, you know, Ugo Mola, notoriously as a coach, doesn't play with too much structure, but they just played and they kept playing and they kept firing. And, you know, some of the strength and some of the power that those boys show, whether it's, you know, Colby finishing everything off one-on-one, fullbacks, wingers could not get one hand on him, let alone two. Peter Aki in the centre, I mean, absolutely phenomenal, destroying his carries, gain line, offloads, almost freakish. Then you've got, you obviously got Dupont breaking tackles, breaking the line, and Tolofua, you know, young, fine, their new back row boy that's come through. Just, they're frightening in so many different aspects. And there's loads of people we haven't touched on, like Yuan Uge. Again, he was a monster. He was phenomenal at the weekend. And they just have so much power and pace at home against a team in Ulster who were shorn of a few players. I mean, they were frightening. And they absolutely blew them off the pitch. It was insane to watch.
Like you said, Chelsea and Colby at the moment is simply the best player in the world. Huh? He's just untouchable. Well, with Semih Radradra maybe, I don't know. But he's just untouchable. It seems like nobody can actually catch him. It is that freakish. And to top it, to link it to what we were talking about before, you have to remember that 5 years ago, they were in Challenge Cup. Huh?
Oh, they were terrible.
They were not the same Toulouse as before. And they've rejuvenated, thanks to a passion, a team spirit, a brotherhood. There's a guy that I know very well, Joe Tecori. I don't know if you... Did you play with him in CAS, Johnny?
No, I didn't play with him, but we've had a few nights out together. He holds a changing room together. He's an amazing guy.
He's a top dude that literally will create a culture almost on its own. We compare it to Saracens, yeah, but they all speak English. In France, the main problem is that you need to get different nationalities, different languages to actually bond together. Sometimes it's going to be with zero words. It's going to involve the glass of wine most of the time, but it can also involve different things. And Joe is a key element. He's the anchor of this team. And so yeah, to link it what we were saying, not only they've got the Chelsea and Colby and all the guys that you mentioned, Johnny, for sure, but on top of that, they've got that brotherhood, which I hate to admit because it kills me inside, but it's true. That's what got them to stay in the fight in Clermont with two men down. That's what got them to win the titles 2 years ago. And that's what's getting them to produce some phenomenal rugby at the moment.
And from a positive to a negative, just down the road from Toulouse, CAST had to forfeit their Challenge Cup quarterfinal at Leicester because they had four positive tests for coronavirus in their ranks. But they weren't happy about it at all, were they?
No, but unfortunately, that's where we are in world sport right now. I mean, we all want to see the contest. We want to give them a fair shot. For any team to be eliminated without having set a foot on the field is horrible, gut-wrenching, and rightly so, the players are devastated. But that just unfortunately the way life is at the minute. And obviously, they kicked up a fuss. They're not happy, but you can't take the field. It's just, it is the way it is. So it's devastating for them as a group not to be able to take part, and to be knocked out in that way is unprecedented. And for the playing group, for the coaching staff, and for the supporters, it's heinous.
It was quite a strong statement that they put out and then kind of seemed to retract. But they accused EPCR of amateurism because they said there was no rule specifically about the number of positive tests that would mean they would have to forfeit the game. And then they also said that none of the players who were due to travel tested positive and they were in their kind of wider squad. So, I mean, do you have any sympathy with them or do you think fair's fair and four tests, you've got to cancel the game?
You have to have sympathy with a team that wants to go and beat Leicester at home for a quarterfinal that they deserve to be there for, that they've worked hard for. Fly the whole team, and once you're in front of the pitch, they tell you no. I mean, you have to feel for them. That's is pretty tough. In the global problem that this pandemic is causing to the world, you have to say, like Johnny says, listen, that's the state that we are all in at the moment. You can't afford to complain. I think what they were pissed off about is what you said, Tim, is that the guys who tested positive were within the squad, not even traveling. So the squad who was traveling, I think, did a test on the Thursday morning because they have to, and none of them were positive. But I'm not a doctor. But if when I know, I've seen that, for instance, the Prime Minister of France was on the Tour de France just for a visit. And the head of Tour de France actually caught it, got tested positive for COVID. So the Prime Minister, because he got in contact with him to show example, had to self-isolate for 14 days, test again, negative. He was negative all the time, never caught it, and then went again. The sport has to lead by example, unfortunately.
And also in the Challenge Cup, you mentioned you were there, Benji, but Sergio Parisse came on the podcast last week, scored the try, the 1-2 on the game. So how was the game, first of all, but also the pitch? What was going on with the pitch? It's not helping, is it?
I don't know what's, I mean, you're like the 10th person to ask me. We didn't speak about the pitch once. You Brits need to get away from the grass and the green and the rain and the weather and this and that. The pitch wasn't that bad. Yes, it was maybe not perfect, but it honestly, it wasn't that bad. Maybe it looked worse on the TV than actually the way that, did you hear any of the Scarlets players complain about it?
All of them.
I mean, surely, yeah. Surely the Welsh cannot complain about a bit of rain and a bit of mud, but it honestly wasn't that bad. But Sergio, really, really happy to see him. He had a good game. He had a very good game. He played 78 minutes, I think, again, a very solid rugby. He actually said to me before the game that he had a great time chatting to us. So I was really pleased. And he's just a class act. And I spoke to the coaches before. They're saying, listen, he's just class. He's just class all over him. So he did really well. And for the little story, they got a first try cancelled for just slight knock on in the first half. A beautiful try with three offloads sort of consecutive with a tiny bit of a forward pass. And Sergio scored. And he still ended up by scoring the other one. So, you know, he's the big fella is still hanging in there. He's still running support lines. He's still led by the front against a tough Scarlets team, to be fair, who did really well and who gave them a good run for their money.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Well, it's about time we've got a guest on now, and he'll have had a keen eye on the Champions Cup semi-finals at the weekend, but possibly from the comfort of his own sofa nowadays. It's former Racing and All Black star Joe Rokothoko. How are you?
Good, boys. Good to be here. Good to have a bit of a chat about footy, and excited for this weekend for the boys.
So for those of the listeners that don't know, set the scene for us. Where are you and what are you up to nowadays?
Well, obviously, I retired about coming up to 2 years now. I finished off at Racing 92 here in Paris, and currently working with the academy boys in terms of helping out with attack and defence with backs and a bit of sevens as well. So that's my role at the moment.
And how's that all going? Are they good, the Racing youngsters?
Mate, yeah, they're good, mate. It's a massive talent here. Good challenging for myself, especially with the language and so forth. But yeah, just it's awesome to seeing young guys grow.
So obviously not a bad mentor to have in yourself coming in, Joe. Possibly one of the best converts to go through is a few guys making the transition through to coaching. Now being involved in the setup, you obviously watched Racing at the weekend. What did you make of the pro boys and the game that they had against Clermont?
I guess first and foremost is just the amount of young guys who came from the system who actually took part in that game. I think we had about 9 to 8 players coming through our academy system. That was pleasing to see. And seeing them playing at that level was awesome. Just obviously, the spectators weren't there, but the intensity of the game was surely there. I kind of died off, obviously. Couldn't hear much because of the refs coughing majority of the game. but in terms of that, it was a good match to watch.
Joe, I mean, I'm not liking the smile that you have on your face when you mention the club all off the home.
I have to be careful, mate. I have to be careful with my words.
That's a bit of a tough one. Now, it was a well-deserved win, 150%. I was just going to, you mentioned the number of guys that went through the academy. So the image of Jackie Lorenzetti's project in Racing, for people who actually don't know it from within, is that he's just signing huge names, the Andrew Mertens originally, and Gus Pichot, and obviously all those other big, big names. But to be fair to him, so he created an unbelievable training center, and he's becoming sort of the best. So Racing is becoming again sort of the best youngster setup in France. I mean, the Collingard, the Colombe, and all those guys come from an academy where they patrol the whole of France basically for the best talent. Correct me if I'm wrong, but the under-17s, the under-19s are absolutely killing everyone at the moment. And their main focus is to get sort of, players from Paris originally if they can, but just from their academy back into the first team.
Yeah, that's exactly it. You don't see, as a player, you see more being involved with the academy now. Just the driven about, it's awesome to see a French club really passionate about their young boys, passionate about them coming through the system. And if we cannot, mold them into be top 14 players, we want them to be the best Pro-2 second division player. Or maybe Federal One, but our goal is trying to, and the club's goal is trying to get the best out of these players as best as possible to prepare them to their next level.
And so linking that to your career, Jay, obviously growing up in Fiji and then moving to New Zealand, what's the system in France like for youngsters compared to what you experienced in New Zealand?
It's interesting. Maybe you don't know. It's a lot of differences. I guess we're more hands-on. And development-wise, I guess the skill set, you rely more coming to your club to be developed. Rather, in New Zealand, it's in the schools. You at lunchtime, you'd be playing touch rugby. And here, you'd be playing football, soccer. And the only time you get to work on your craft is when you come into your club, your clubs, and you work on your skills and so forth. So our development early on has really been built in the playgrounds. And, there's a few academies around New Zealand who look at the talent early on and they just keep an eye on them from age group, and they put the right people for that player. For example, me being involved under 16s, I always had a guy that wasn't part of my career during Auckland development and carried on to New Zealand under 18s and so forth. So they keep a close eye on you and the development part. And obviously, NZRFU works closely with the clubs, and the relationship between the clubs and the actual general union is one goal, is trying to create the best player to be a future All Black or a future Super Rugby. While here, it's quite different between the club, it's conscious on their player, and the national team are not really connected, as we know.
I've got one more question. It's that at the weekend, I was with your good mate, Ice Toyava.
Oh, Ice.
And we were chatting about, because I just moved to England. And I got picked up by my local rugby club there to do a little bit of coaching. Yeah. They're like fifth division. At the end of the session, they were all chatting, doing a feedback review of their attitude and the skills and the this and that. And I'm looking at them as like, I mean, even in second division in France, they won't do it. You go to fifth division in France, there's a guy probably smoking in the middle of the huddle at the end. And he's barely looking at it, scratching his balls and this and that. The boys were getting bollocks. They were getting bollocks for being 2 minutes late. I mean, they all have full-time jobs and this and that. And Ice was like, mate, you go to club rugby in New Zealand. That's 100% how it is. You've got standards. You've got levels. It's got nothing to do with the level that you play at. It's, you got to go full on, work on your craft with this. And the second thing he was telling me, tell me if you agree, he reckons that he's never been part of a country that's such a waste of talent within the youngsters. Like, he's telling me the talent in here is just next level. He's comparing Damien Penaud. So Damien Penaud, I don't know if you know him personally, but he's completely cool.
He's a character, yeah.
Yeah, he's lovely, but he never trains. He never does anything, but he's just gifted. And he's like, give me a guy like that in a proper setup. I'll make him the best player in the world. Like, he's got nothing to be ashamed compared to any other team. So do you agree on that?
I totally agree. Like, I've seen players, especially just when we were involved here, the Super Sevens was done here in the arena early in the year. Just the amount of young, talented players around. Some players get lost because of their journey, because they don't take it as serious. And, they don't actually know the talent and the qualities they have to go up to the next level. It's like the vision of the Rupeni Thaothaos of this world. You know, they've got so much talent. They'll turn up when they want to, but they won't go up to the next level. And I've seen it here as well. When they work off their instinct, French, as we know, they use their French flair. They just come so natural in the way they play. But it's the small details, as you say, the turning up, the being precise and being consistent in the way you do your skills, the way you do your preparation every week. That's just the missing part. But I've seen the last few years here in racing, especially. I'm just talking on behalf because I'm here most of the time. They're changing, their mental side of that game has changed the last 3 years, and it's good to see.
See, I think to touch on that again, I think from my experience, similar to Joe, Scotland's a small country, small population, so you have to work your backside off to get the most out of what we have because it's really small. I arrived in France and I almost found coaching, it was more like somebody would pick the team and they would pay foreigners to come in, but that was it. There wasn't much on skill development or technique or strategy, or everything was a level down. And so I found it's like a vicious circle. Like, coaches haven't had to coach because there's been a reliance on foreign talent, but that's now all about change. That's where it's exciting. You've got guys like Joe that are part of a system now where you get to educate young French kids. And because of GIF numbers having to go up, they're all going to get game time. So I agree, there's this massive bank of talent that's not tapped into. Now it's all going to get game time. We've seen 2 years of under-20s absolutely killing it. And now we're going to see, I hope, that the French team over the next 5, 10, 15 years is going to dominate. You know, when I was growing up, I loved watching them and I want to see them there every time they play. And I think that's the first building block, is getting young French kids upskilled, teaching them properly. And then you're also going to develop another layer of coaches. I think you've lost a sort of generation of a formation of coaches coaching and more people just selecting teams. And now what we're going to see in France is another raft of young French coaches that want to teach kids, that want to learn themselves, want to get better. And that's only going to drag everything up. So it's exciting to see. I wanted to ask you, Joe, from the conversations we've had before previously about when you were back home and things you were learning, for instance, when you were 17, 18 with coaches like Graham Henry. I remember you said when you first arrived in Bayonne, the first team and the pro team, which would have been mid-2000s, were doing what you were doing when you were 17. So how hard did you find it to adapt to French rugby and adapt to the French system when you first arrived in the country?
It was precisely that. I think we talked about the simple drills that you learned early on in New Zealand, where my under-18 coach was Joe Smith, Smithy. So he's detailed. So he's running lines, angles, lying. Then you had Wayne Smith in your earlier career, and he's lying with your eyes, looking this way, but changing your body angles. So it was all that stuff was from 18 to 21. You're learning all the small details. But coming into Bayonne, it was my first few months was quite difficult, because we had a few drills that they finally started doing when we've learnt way back. I was a bit surprised in terms of that. But I kind of understood where the development was still catching up with the rugby-wise of understanding what to do during training. And I found it pretty hard in the beginning to adapt. It didn't help myself going into the season not really mentally there, physically kind of drained, because I actually missed out on the squad, the initial squad, in 2011. And I came to Bayonne, so that didn't help with my adapting to the game. And I assumed things just to happen. You know, I thought things would just happen for me. The structure of the game should be more open, but it wasn't. It was, it was starting to think, where your gloves are on the wing now, because, it was ballon porté, drive, your job is high ball. And it was like, I think we'd done about 10 moves, backline moves during the week, and we'd done one move in the game, because that's... Your game plan was to play wide, but it comes to the game, it's all close game. So it was hard to adapt, but I kind of learned, and later on the following year was quite better. I was just how can I adjust myself to the system, and how could I put my style of game into how they try to play. So if it was driving the ball, was trying to work off the ball, trying to do decoy rather than sitting in the wing and complaining. So it was pretty hard, but adapted in the end.
You said about that, having a number of backs, back moves, and not doing them in Bayonne. That's what happens when you have a fullback called Scott Spitting, who's built like a freaking fridge. And he's bigger than most back rows that you would ever see. And he loves a bit of contact. So he's probably just dumbing to you all the time, just waiting for it to happen.
I think my biceps are still sore on that. Yeah.
Just on that, I remember, I obviously I don't know anything about how it was from inside, but at the time in Bayonne, everybody was on your ass about not scoring tries. And I remember I don't know if you read the French press or whatever, but it was sort of, they were always waiting, when is he going to score? However good you played, it was just, when is he going to score? When is he going to see this scoring machine from NZ? You sort of wrapped up. So you're expecting big things. And then again, to touch on what Ice and stuff from a conversation I had with him, he was telling me that the pressure in New Zealand on the ABs is just next level. How could you compare the pressure of not scoring tries in Bayonne to the pressure of basically, you had to do even more than winning basically for the ABs back in NZ?
Yeah, that's a good question, because there was another level. I guess the first few months I was like, I'm so happy I couldn't understand French because of the articles. And when you ran off the field, I was so happy. Whatever they were saying, I couldn't understand. Well, everything's changed now. But in terms of of pressure. Yeah, you know, I wasn't playing my best, to be honest. It starts for me. Mentally wasn't there, and physically wasn't as fit as I should have been, and kind of went expecting things to work, and people were expecting a lot from me. And going into the preseason in the airport, I kind of told myself, I made a promise to myself, I should really let my standards down, because obviously these people are putting pressure on you, because the club, the community, the whole town had invested in you to come and play for them and do your best. And here you come, you're not living up to your expectation, which I felt real gutted in the end. So my whole drive in preseason was to firstly get, before getting respect from the community and the players, I had to do my hard work. I had to look at myself first. And we always know you're an all-black player 24-7 and not only playing, but you had to train like one. So for instance, my first training preseason, I had to train like one. You know, all my action had to be like that and improved. I got the respect. I had to get my respect for myself. The second one was to get respect for my players in terms of working hard for them and doing everything the best I could for my team. And obviously, the community was the third objective. And once I had those things in line, things worked better. And the pressure came of scoring tries, and the tries came later on. But my first goal was to actually perform for my teammates first, and then the spectators.
And you mentioned, Jay, that mentally you maybe weren't quite in the right place or the place you wanted to be when you first arrived. I mean, Can you put your finger on why that was? Was it because obviously you had such a successful All Blacks career? You're a permanent fixture for, you know, nearly a decade, played in a couple of World Cups, but then you mentioned yourself were left out by Graham Henry for 2011. So, I mean, take us back to that time. Like, what did he say to you? How much of a shock was it? How did you feel at the time? And then bringing that over to France as well.
The good thing about the relationship we've had with the coaches throughout those years was, you know, they had, when at times that I didn't make it through, they made efforts. Like Graham was in Auckland. He'll ring me up if I missed up. I missed up two times occasions in the selection. He'll bring, if you weren't performing during the year, he'd totally invite you to his house and say, actually, what's happening? What's going wrong? And obviously, with the last selection, it's always bad. Obviously, when you get the call, when you see the phone number and it's Ted, it's like, oh, okay, there's. But he was, he just said, I'm sorry, you hadn't made the team. And I was at peace in some ways. I was ready to move on. Kind of ready to move on because I really signed for Bayonne, but I wanted to finish off in the high. But I just wished them all the best and move. I thought I was ready at peace, but arriving in Bayonne, it was a whole new switch of culture and expectations, like Benji said, came all at once. Mentally, was still kind of dragging this, you know, disappointment. And at the same time, you're expecting things just to happen now. So that kind of, it was quite hard, like I said, in the first few months. But, you know, I'm glad it kind of happened because it kind of rebooted myself. I really thought about myself to actually come back to your roots as working hard on my faith. And with Christophe Delo, he was old school. Christian Lanta, you know, they're old school coaches. First meeting, you know, for them, the following season, sit down, Christophe is straight face, and Scott Speeding is my translator, and he's just laughing in between and shaking his head. And so Christophe is explaining, and Scott goes, Scott, what he said? He just said, he doesn't care who you are, what you've done. For me, you're going to start from the bottom and you've got to earn your way. And I went, perfect. That's what I need. I just need someone, just tell me straight, put me back in my place, restart and go again. And you know, massive respect for those two coaches. They did things old school, but sometimes you need some old school things to get you back to your place.
Things did come quickly at the start of your career in New Zealand, didn't they? Because you won a Super Rugby title in your first season. You were straight into the All Blacks. You were scoring tries at a ridiculous rate. And I think you were the youngest All Black since Joe Naloma as well, and broke his single season try scoring record. So, I mean, it was a different kind of pressure when you moved to France, but you were obviously used to the pressure, because being compared to Joe Naloma, there can be no greater pressure.
Yeah, I've learned a lot from my years. I guess for the first year, because not much people knew about me. I didn't even know there was a World Cup during that year, to be honest, let alone be selected for Super Rugby. So everything just came one after another. And I was just playing as it goes. Selected with Super Rugby. Next, I'm playing Super. I hadn't even had a chance to play ITM Cup. because of playing sevens and I got injured. And then next thing you're being talked about making the ABs, and ABs was like massive, and still didn't know there was a World Cup that year because I had no plans on being involved in any of those teams. And so I had gone through the motions, gone through the ride, and throughout the years, I've just expected things to happen like how it happened in 2003. Well, things change, obviously, as all players know, that people read you more, understand you more, the game moves on. There's more high balls now. There's no more, you know, there's more contesting for the ball in the air. So I had to develop myself and not just rely on my talent as I did in my first year, talent and instinct. I had to grow as a player as well, because the game kind of moved on as well. And I had to do more high balls because I lost heaps of balls in my first time. It wasn't the last time that Springboks done bombs, but I had to develop my game as well, and I had to mature pretty early. Early in my career, and I've done that roller coaster career thing, and obviously going into France was another movement, learned, and I felt like for myself I played my best rugby in my last few years in France, enjoyment wise and being in development wise.
In terms of developing as a young fella, you came in very early, but what was it like to walk into a dressing room and have guys, you know, a multitude of different characters? You had Mills Malaina, you had Dougie Howlett, you'd have Rupeni, like all these guys to learn from and the different things you took from them. What were they like and how much did they help you as a young boy coming into that environment?
Oh, massively, especially those boys who are in the Blues squad. You know, with Carlos, starting with Carlos, his whole thing was trying to get the ball out wide. I just want my wings to touch the ball. That was his whole aim. And if you're not an option, if you don't get the ball on the outside, I want you hanging inside ball. So if there's not an inside ball, there's a banana kick coming to your way. So he's always, you know, he's always wanting me to, or the wingers outside, to get the ball. In terms of Mills, he was kind of pretty much my mentor at fullback. He always had this conversation at the back. You can always feel confident about your safety of going up or covering. He was always a guy that gave me feedback during the game and see if I was right upstairs. And Roops, obviously, my first ever preseason game. We played the Hurricanes, and it, you know, being 19, you're marking Jonah, and you got Tan on the other side, and you got Cullen at the back, and you got Alamiri and Mia and Peter Latini and Jason Spice and Martin Noni's replacement. And so I'm 19, seeing these guys, I was like, man, what am I doing here? And the first ever kick goes deep. And let alone that Jonah gets the ball. I was going, please pass. Because I'm chasing the ball because the ball didn't go out. He runs to the middle, looks to go open, then he does that. He knows I'm a young kid, so I've always said about Jonah, he always tried to test a young kid. He runs towards the middle, then he does a massive step off his right and comes back to my 15-meter line. And I was just like, here it is. This is life. This is like what you watch every time, and you're about to get the full experience of it. So close my eyes, Matt. Close my eyes, prayed so much. By the time I opened my eyes, all I remember was holding my leg, and my family was on the sideline, so it was quite a close game. And all I can see, my brother's laughing in the sideline, me dragging out his leg. But it was my welcome to Super Rugby. And obviously in that game, before that game, Roops came up to me. He could tell I was nervous, and he'd been doing it for a long time. And he said, hey, bro, I guess you're right. He goes, yep. Yeah. When you get the ball, bro, just think about flying. Just when you get the ball, think about flying. And I wonder why he does this all the time, because every time he gets the ball, he flies. And that was that one advice that Rupert said, just back yourself and just imagine you're flying and you're just, no one can catch you. So, so a lot of those guys have played a big part.
And did Jonah give you advice as well when you started, particularly your All-Black career? Did he give you some advice?
Like, sadly enough, that was his last actual two games preseason, and he didn't play Super Rugby because of the kidney. And that's the whole reason we all got kind of made ourselves selected in that squad that year. That was preseason 2003. But prior to that 2002, the ABs had a camp in Auckland, and they invited some up-and-coming players who might be future ABs. And they invited me as an 18-year-old to go across to that camp just to train. There was Jonah and Cully, and they're my two massive heroes. Went into that room, and you could tell I was a bit shy, and he was the first guy to come across to say, bro, how are you doing? Because, you know, didn't know what to say, man. I was just saying, oh, good, good, yeah, good. And he said, what's your name? I explained. And he said, oh, how was Christmas? And I was like, man, this guy's, I thought it was just, oh, how are you doing? And that's it. But I don't know what to say. It was just the old short one answer. Yes, good. Yes, good. Like as you do as Islanders, so you nod your head. But yeah, that was a massive impact. And he, you know, I just watched him work at the gym. Just watching these boys work and the standards and trying to raise every time. John Mitchell at that time was trying to bring in some young guys just to get a taste of what to expect if you want to be in this level. And I did. And what I got from the first day was how kind they were and how humble they were to bring me in and make me feel at home at ease.
And one other guy that you mentioned there from your time at the Blues was Carlos Spencer. So first of all, what was he like to play with? And second of all, obviously you're at Racing now. In your final season, you played with Finn Russell and now you obviously know him really well. So are there comparisons there? Because he's always called a maverick.
Oh, mate, yeah. I'm not sure if Finn has done any gym this whole career, mate. he turns up. As long as the trainer sees him, does a thumbs up, he tears, looks at the mirror, then he's off to the physio room. But that's why he's injured. I was giving him a hard time earlier on this week, his injury on his shoulder, because it's his first tackle of his career. So he's trying to ice that off at the moment. But he's a character. He's a bit of a Carlos, but a Scottish version.
Taylor.
We'll take it.
But he's more the guy that you see in the he's from the pub, you know. He doesn't play professional rugby, the next thing, and he's killing it. You know, he's one of those players that we love. He backs himself. He knows when to do the two, when to be serious and direct players, and when to enjoy himself. And he's been awesome for us, and we've been fortunate enough. We've had some good tens come past. And Carlos was the same. You know, he's reading the play. He's just creating opportunities, but you can never take your eye off him because he can do a dummy and then he's gone. And that's like for penny tricks, because you just look at him. He's so lethargic, and it looks lethargic, but he's like dizzy. You know, they're so calm as tens. You don't know what to expect. You know, he can be looking this way, then he knows their space are wide and he does a massive cross kick. And he's been playing awesome. Gutted didn't make his line. He's unlucky to make that online trip to New Zealand. And, you know, it's been interesting, these tens coming up to be chosen in the Lions tour to South Africa. For me, he's awesome at the moment. He's playing real well. And he's just growing confidence at the moment.
And for me, looking back, when I enjoyed my rugby as a young kid watching, Carlos Spencer was always the guy that I idolised. But for me, Finn is the guy that embodies New Zealand spirit and how you want an attacking 10 to play. Just how good do you think Finn can be if he pushes on? Do you think he can go and start and be the first choice for the Lions if he applies himself?
If he does, you know, I rate him, not just because I just play with the guy and he's got some lame jokes, but he's a good player, bro. If he can rule, upskill himself and continue to grow, you know, because obviously players, again, will analyze how you play, but for him, I think he's just waiting for the big stage, that extra big stage to perform. You know, he's been playing, obviously, and do different competitions here in Europe. But the next stage, obviously, he's done international. But for him to really test himself is that Lions tour. And I'm sure he's working hard at it. It's the hardest I've seen him work this year. No, he's a great talent, mate. So I'm sure we'll see him in that level soon.
Enough with the Scots already. I mean, come on. First it's Racing, then it's the Scots. I know you've got the one who can be starting for the Lions, but enough. But a serious question, though. You could never see a Frenchman, obviously, in entering the British and Irish Lions. Not even just because it's not in the rules. Just there is a difference of culture, right, that you can sort of address and see. If you could pick the odd guy, like the Sergio Parisse or whatever. But if you could pick one French international, who do you think could make the next British and Irish Lions tour? Do you think like Virimi Vakatawa? Do you think Teddy Thomas, if he buys himself half a brain? even Teddy Ribaren. I mean, he's probably one of the most underrated players in France, but that he's for me one of the symbol of French rugby. He's raggedy, weird, but bloody hell, he's got a lot of talent.
Yeah, he's a name that I guess most players that know him well will agree to, Benji, because of his You see some of his tackles when he comes off the line. He just gives it everything. And he's tackling guys like who are 20 or 40 kilos heavier than him. So he's got, like you said, he's got the French spirit. He's all rough and tough. And he's real intelligent as well. Knows when to kick. He's got a good left foot on him. And he controls the game really well. And he's got a lot of respect from the boys as well. So, yeah, Teddy will hype. And there's a lot. If I had to choose, Teddy Tonga would be good, I guess. He'll fit in somewhere like that. But in saying, like you said, Teddy Tonga is mature now. He's changed.
No, he's not. I will never believe it. And if he hears that he can be picked for the Irish Lions, I'm telling you, he's going to be in Vegas next week or something. He will never play rugby again. He's gone.
No, we've had issues with that. We finished with that cup.
So going back to your career, obviously we spoke about when you came to Bayonne and the cultural differences there. Obviously you were there for a while and then moved to Racing. So, I mean, first of all, how did that move come about? Obviously, I know Bayonne got relegated, but did Jackie Lorenzetti woo you? What did he wine and dine you, or how did it come about? And what was the differences between those two clubs?
We talked about the situations of if Bayonne got relegated. So we eventually did, and I spoke to my wife, and there was a few clubs on board and wanted to take me on board, and I asked my wife what does she want, and she said, it's up to you, what do you want? And the question was, if I've done enough, and now is my this time of my career to help the young, or I haven't played Championship Cup, try to have a crack. To at least say I had a chance to get this experience of playing top level rugby. And after the Barbas, after the season, Bayonne, we went and played Barbas. And I told my agent, now I think my role is to play in Bayonne. So I said no to all the clubs, and I was meant to stay with Bayonne to go down second division. Went on holiday to Fiji. Got a phone call from my agent, and the club said, they'll love to keep you, but things might be complicated. But you might have to leave on your own terms, obviously. Because I just signed 3 years. If you to stay and they want you out, obviously the club had to look up, pay you out. So I was like, wow. So this isn't a holiday. So I had to decide to stay or go. I had 3 weeks to decide for a club, look for a house in a school, and all with while drinking in Fiji. So that. I told my agent, can you go back to those clubs that were interested and say, you know, because I knew if I had to stay in Bayonne, I wasn't helping the club. I wasn't helping the club, even if I was staying there, for them to move on and develop and find other options. I had to, my way was to go to another club, and there was my journey. That's my destiny. So I kind of got forced in that hand, and Racing, a few clubs came, but Racing came straight to the table and just said 3 years, and I didn't want to be doing a lot of moving around. And for me and my family, I have three boys, and that was mainly it. Racing came 3 years. I knew things were quite expensive here with property, with the house and family. I spoke with O'Gara. I had a good conversation with Roger O'Gara, Ronan, and he said blah, blah, blah. And I just said, Roger, if you could just do this, my word, I'll sign tomorrow. And he did it. And other clubs came and got actually improved with the offer. But kept my word. No, Rod, you guys didn't muck me around. And I see your guys' vision. And I actually forgot that Dan actually signed for a few Kiwi boys signed at the same year. So it was all good timing, good vibe, and a good mixture of guys coming in as well with Yannick and Talo as well, from Caso. It was a good time. We had a good vibe and things worked well.
And when you arrived, Joe, your coaches were Laurent Labitte and Laurent Travers. What were they like as a coaching duo? They obviously had a really good rep coming from Cast, having won a title down there. They replicated it up in Racing. But how good were they as a team? Obviously, now one of them is away with the French team. But together, how good were they as a force?
Oh, they were good. In terms of the level of coaching, it changed dramatically because this is the first time I've actually been around French coaches when they demand players for their opinions. What do you reckon we should do here? We do this, but give that second option for feedback and give the responsibility for leaders, creating leadership groups to take care of this. But the organization obviously had one good cop, one bad cop, and they changed all the time, as you do. But they work perfectly well, and they've been successful together throughout the years. you know, they knew how to get a team up, and when things weren't going too well, you know, they worked well, tried to get the best out of players, and that's all you can ask for as a team.
And you mentioned a bit about the coaching difference in France to New Zealand. Obviously, Laurent Labitte and Laurent Trevert have done very, very well recently. You mentioned Joe Schmidt at the start of your career, Wayne Smith, others. Obviously, you're now on your coaching path. You obviously want to take bits from different coaches. But if you had to say one coach, the best coach you've had in your career, who would it be and why?
That's a tough one. I guess Wayne Smith. Wayne Smith is my coach, if I had to choose out of all of them, just because he keeps things simple. Questions are so simple that you think it's a trick question, but and then you realize he just wants your mind to be ticking and demanding players, because it's only the players on the pitch, and what you see, what you think on training and you practice is what you're going to get in the game. So he's demanding what you see, what you do, how to run lines, but just taking initiative of players to take charge, but him guiding you through the way, which brings confidence in yourself and knowing, oh, he has confidence in me, but he can test me as well. So it can be a questions can be so simple as, okay, there's two versus one on the short side. What do you do? And it's like, do you hold the ball? It's like, so simple, but you just go and pass. Voila. But he just wants you to keep repeating the hit, so it's instinct, you know, so you don't overthink things. But and his encouragement, you know, he was awesome, and just said the right things at the right time. I think one season he was in charge of defense coach. He was a defensive coach for the ABs, and we had a tour in Europe. It had been a long time when we won the Grand Slam, and that was our goal, and he was in charge of defense. And before leaving New Zealand, he said that he talked about, does anyone remember about the Black Plague that happened in Europe? Some of us didn't know. Some of us just knew right then. He explained the details. And he said, for our defense has to be like the Black Plague in Europe. When we get there, Europe knows we've arrived. And that just put an image in our head. Just little things so he can get players to that level. And by the time we got to Europe, we were so driven in our head. We wanted to be this black force that came to Europe and just took charge of defense, or aggressive and dominant, and little things like that, which really stood out for me.
And in terms of your own coaching career then, Joe, you're obviously at the academy now. I mean, what's your kind of vision for your own coaching future? Do you want to be a head coach at some point? Do you want to stay in Europe? Do you want to go back to the Southern Hemisphere?
Bit of everything. I'm playing by it at the moment. For myself, is just trying to learn more how the academy system works of recruiting players and managing players, and then trying to see players grow. As you know, it's your massive responsibility of trying to give the tools to these boys to make them go to the next level, which excites me. And it's the end package, as you see, is the development for the next few months. And for me, it's trying to be around the academy, young boys, obviously, and we see from there. But at the moment, my whole focus is now is just trying to learn and teach these young boys at the same time of passing on the experience. So by the time they take that extra step to pro rugby, I hope they're well equipped and ready.
You've obviously taken that step already in France, Joe, but for our listeners that don't know, you've obviously also invested with Anthony Tuitavaki and a few other big names in Kiwi rugby out in America and the MLR in Hawaii. You've taken over a new team. So what are your hopes and expectations for the team out in Hawaii that you set up, and what kind of role will you be taking going forward with them?
I think it's a good question, because it's actually interlinks with each other. On this role happening now, I'm more of a clear understanding how everything I could do to improve of development players, developing players from the Pacific. So our role is more looking over things and how structure-wise of how we should work as young coaches, preparing players to the expectations, and of not only on the field but off the field as well. So, you know, be with a few players on board that who could help with that. And just with the relationship between understanding what young Pacific players go through and what they, especially at home, and how to manage that when you go to the next level, and the expectation is what you're going to expect. So it's more development for my role anyway, being part of it is working with the young boys and trying to get into this academy system and getting them ready as well to, you know, the big lights, the big world with the big competitions.
So we're not going to see a president slash head coach of Hawaii, is that what we're saying?
No, man, I'll take the back seat and I'll sleep like this changing room. That'd be my one job.
I was going to say, if you need a French assistant coach or a Scottish assistant coach or a media guy, I'm sure we're all interested.
Consultant, a no, couple of weeks a year, man. I'll be there. Don't worry, Joe.
No worries, mate. Well, Scottish need some time, bro.
That's great. Thanks ever so much for joining us, Joe. And good luck with the coaching journey with the Racing Academy and then wherever it leads you in future.
Cheers, boys.
Cheers, Joe. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Legend.
He's a legend. And also, so we talked about his down times in Bayonne. Like, obviously, he had tough times at the start and it didn't go well. And, you know, French crowds can be tough and he was booed. But he is an absolute gent. He worked his arse off. And by the end of his time at Bayonne, like, he is an absolute local celebrity. They absolutely love him. He's a superstar down here. I was at the Fête de Bayonne with him last year. He couldn't move for people. We couldn't do anything or go and get a beer because he was swamped. He is absolutely loved. So he was really, really, not disparaging, but almost talked himself down about the start of his Bayonne journey. But by the time he left here, he was so good. He's absolutely adored. And he's an amazing bloke. So great guest to have on.
Well, there's a bit of news to chat about too in just a minute. But first, we've spoken about the quarterfinals of Europe earlier on. Obviously, the semifinals coming up straight off the back of them this weekend. So let's find your predictions for them. What's going to happen in the Champions Cup semifinals this weekend?
So you got Exeter Toulouse. I'll be covering that for French TV. And I have to say, in front of zero crowd, is a particularity that has to be taken into consideration. Exeter is a tough old place. I just feel that Toulouse are strong enough to make a statement there. They've got the thing with Exeter is that they're extremely forward dominant. They're fantastic in the scrum and the driving more and all that. So are Toulouse. If there's one team that can punch them in the mouth with that power, it's them. And to be fair, I've played Exeter a few times. If you dominate them up front, they don't really have a plan B. They're extraordinarily powerful, extraordinarily organized, fantastic unity within the court. You can see they've got a great drive. But I really do think that Toulouse can challenge them. And so it will be a hell of a game. And it's almost going to be on the neutral ground. And to talk about the second semi, very tight as well. I mean, Racing at home are obviously favorites, but Saracens, bloody hell. In Leinster, they really impressed me. So it's going to be one of those games that's going to be extremely tight margins. If Flynn Russell is out of breath and collapsed under Mario Toge's sort of empowerment, then it's going to be a tough one. So unbelievably close two games, semi-final of Europe, it's pretty normal.
I can't call them at all. Like, traditionally, Exeter, you think at home, they've got everything, but then so do Toulouse. And for me, that's going to be an absolute coin toss. I have no idea who's going to win that game, but I can't wait to watch it. I was meant to be working at it too, but can't travel because of lockdown, which is great. So I'll get to watch it on the couch with my kids jumping on my head, which will be fun. And again, Racing Saracens, we talked about him earlier, but the key for me in unlocking the whole thing is Finn Russell. Can Finn Russell deal with that squeeze in Saracens' defense? Can he play in faces as he has done all year over the past couple of years in France and have that flair? And will he be allowed to play? You know, teams also struggle to go to Paris synthetic pitch. Saracens playing a synthetic pitch, absolutely used to it. So I'm expecting fireworks extra to lose. And for me, Racing Saracens can Finn unlock that game and cut and weave his magic. Again, really tough to call the two. I've got no idea.
You're not getting away that easy, both of you. Splinters, sat on the fence so much, both of you. Come on, give us two. Is it going to be an all-French final?
We're not a betting agency here. We don't necessarily need to put the games.
I want to know where to put my money.
I'll play Racing at home, very, very tight, and I'll play Toulouse away. So
All-French.
Yeah, I do think it's going to be all-French. Very, very tight, but I think this one's going
to
happen.
I'm more inclined to go for Exeter at home. There'll be a different sort of tightness to that game, a different game management from Exeter. They might control it because they have done so well the past couple of years in the Premiership. I'm going to go Exeter at home because they're incredibly, even with no crowd, they'll be incredibly hard to beat. That tips it in that favour. Another point we didn't talk about, I want to go for Racing at home, But we haven't talked again about the Saracens scrum, which absolutely demolished Leinster, which also kind of worries me for Racing. But I don't know, just I think they're on form, they're confident, they've got top class, world class players in their back line, and young boys doing a job up front. So I'm gonna go two home wins. I'm gonna go Exeter at home and Racing at home.
And in the Challenge Cup, obviously it's the semi-Randrandra derby. Can Bordeaux win away at Bristol?
To be fair, I mean, Bristol was very impressive last year. I think they still, to me personally, the few times that I saw them, they're still sort of gently getting there, having added Semi Radradar, who's only like one of the best players in the world at the moment, Kyle Sinclair, Ben Earl, and all those guys. I was actually expecting more of them. They completely outmuscled, outplayed Dragons. Make them look like a second division team. So they are hot. They're ready to go. But Bordeaux will just be missing. If they could just like trip up Semi Radradra or something, you know, like, I don't know, send them some sort of send them a case of wine or something. But I mean, he is a freak. He is at the moment. I mean, I don't know if you saw that. You can summon his form up at the moment by that try he scored against Dragons. He's almost slowing down to try to pass the ball to give it to somebody else. He's like, oh, really? Really? No? Bang, one more. And then he's almost waiting. Just, can somebody else score, please? I actually don't want to do the post-match interview. And then bang, he whacks another one and he scores it. I was like, oh. Freak of nature. So I don't think, I think it will be a hell of a game. I think Bordeaux will be just a little bit short because of the lack of games they've played. And on the other semi, which is Toulon getting Leicester, I think unfortunately it's going to be a one-way street for Toulon. The Leicester boys are just not in form enough, and Toulon are good.
I completely agree. I'm going to go two home wins. So I think the way or the difference that Pat Lam has made since he arrived, they are freakish in the way they play with Luatua, with Radrada. And I just think as well, you know, Bordeaux, a bit late to the party, lack of game time. Remy Lamarat, I think, you know, is their sort of muscle man, power player in midfield. He's injured as well. I just don't see how they're going to shackle the Bristol midfield. So for me, Bristol home win, 100%. Toulon, Leicester's harder. I mean, Toulon for me haven't been, it's not like they've been destroying teams, even though they're playing at Mayol. I think that'll be tighter. Even though Leicester are completely in a phase of transition, I think Toulon will win, but I think that's going to be a tight one. That'll be the tougher match to call. But, you know, Sergio continues his rich vein of form and dominates as he's been doing, line out time, try time, podcast time. Yeah, it's going to be a Toulon win for me, definitely too.
And just to wrap up, I mentioned that there's been some news, and it's big news, isn't it? I mean, I'm going to leave you to explain it. Tell us why Bernard Laporte and Mohad Altrad have been taken into custody and what's going on.
I'll take that one, Johnny. You tell me if my heart is making me sort of blind to the reality. But so this is a heavy burden for me, just so you know. And the president of the federation was called and was taken into custody, whatever, for a chat with the police. Is really a heavy burden. So what happened is that 3 years ago, there's two things that happened. One, there was basically a statement from the fans in Montpellier against the league that got banned by the commission. There was a banderole, like a poster in the stands. It wasn't extremely offensive. It was just wrongly put. And so the club of Montpellier got fined, I can't remember what it was, like 50 grand and a game of suspension, blah, blah, blah. That week we heard that, or that during that time, we heard that Altrad, so the president of Montpellier, his company, the scaffolding company, was linked to a big sponsorship contract with the French team. Okay, so we knew that there was something sort of going on. And being told, oh, be careful, guys, because this might be sort of a breach of interest. I don't even call that again. Conflict of interest, exactly. And funnily enough, the commission, who then gave an official statement of 50 grand plus one game banned, the next day, there was 0 day game banned. It was only 10 grand of penalty. So people started thinking, hang on, what's going on? What, you know, who did what? And then there was a rumor that there was a call from the president, sort of Bernard Laporte of the French Federation, to the commission, telling them, chill down, boys. They're going to be main sponsors. Get rid of that stuff. It's the last thing that we need. Okay? No. I never called. I never did anything. He was questioner. And on top of that, a little icing on the cake, we realized during that week that there was an individual contract, an image rights contract between Bernard Laporte for 10 or 15, whatever, speaking gigs to the Altrad company worth 150,000 euros. So that gives you a little soup of, holy wow, that just stinks of bad stuff. But that was 3 years ago. And after that, what happened? the contract got denied. So obviously Bernard Laporte, oh yeah, because I don't get paid to be president of the Federation, so I got to eat. That was his way of saying it. And he's a smart guy. He don't sign with the head sponsor. On top of that, France got the World Cup 2023 gig, and they used the private jet of Altrad for all of them to go to Georgia and all those places. So it just doesn't smell good.
It stinks.
And so Bernard Laporte denied that, renounced or said no to that contract, the individual contract, admitted that he called the commissioner, but he never said that he influenced the decision. So there's decision A, one phone call, decision B, but he doesn't have anything to do with it. And on top of that, within that commission, I think there was like three or four people. One of the guys of the commission said that he knew about that phone call because that night the commissioner who got called him to say, it's an outrage. The president just put pressure on me. He told me to get rid of that sanction, blah, blah, blah. That's never been proved. I'll let you go to it, Johnny, because otherwise I'm going to be there for a while. But the only defense that the Bernard Laporte camp have got at the moment is it's a manipulation of, the French Federation elections are next week. And they said, oh, for the last 3 years, we've been questioned and nothing's come out of it, blah, blah, blah. And they decide to call us and put us in custody the week before the election. It's a manipulation. It's the other camp who are playing with us. But he's never talking about the facts. They're never addressing the reality. His lawyer, my word, he sounds like the Sopranos. Like it's unbelievable the way that he was speaking. He's not talking about his clients outside, but it's the other camp and it's before the elections, completely going above and beyond his position. So all I know is that there's a big sponsor for the Federation. Hallelujah, he's there. All I know is that France got the World Cup 2023 gig, which is an amazing story. I'm just scared that it stinks of dodgy dealings, and that they're gonna have to give answer to the justice system. And I'm just desperate for the truth to come out and for sanctions to come if there need be, but at least put this behind, because it puts a lot of shame on French rugby in general, and it's just not good.
I agree. I don't know, man. Just the whole thing stinks. You've got Altrad, and obviously one of Entrepreneur of the Year 2015, one of the most famous men in France, sponsors the French Federation. I think it's 35 million euros a year he gives to the French Federation. Like, it's huge money. And there's just all sorts of things that come back with it that we see in rugby over here. Obviously, Montpellier, Moed's club, got done for the salary cap. They had a one point something million euro fine, which then got repealed by the FFR. So the LNR banned the club and fined them. And then the FFR turns it over and says, no, these guys are good guys. They can pay 90,000 euros. So there's just so many layers of stinking corruption and politics that I almost don't know how how they dare to try and get away with it. Like, it's so blatant. Like, I don't know how you can try and give a company 35 million euros and not expect something in return. So I don't know. It like you touched on it, it brings a little bit of shame to French rugby. You've now got the president of the FFR, Bernard Laporte, and Moed Altrad, and I think three others. So Serge Simon and a couple of others. You've had five guys in police custody for the past 3 days, which is just something that's just never heard of. Like, in rugby, and we talk about our values, our core values, our culture. And this is just politics and meddling and money that just stinks, and it's not what we need in our sport. So I don't know. I hope it gets ironed out quickly. Obviously, you've got lawyers spouting absolute garbage in the press right now in France, but I just hope it goes to court. I'm not sure how they're going to prove anything, because I don't think you really can. It's happened so long ago. How are they going to trace and get phone calls? And I don't know. Hugely complicated, hugely complex, and not great for French rugby, especially with the big drive to advertise the 2023 World Cup, which is coming in 3 years' time. So not good timing again for Bernard Laporte or for his committee. And yeah, just does not smell good, does not look good. And we'll wait to see what happens next week.
Well, hopefully this one won't drag on, but I've got a feeling it may run and run, and we may well be touching on this again in future podcasts. So we will wait and see. Thanks, Johnny. Thanks, Benji. And thanks to all of you for listening and watching as well. We're on YouTube as well as on all good podcast platforms. So leave us a nice 5-star review or drop us a message if you get a chance. And we'll be back with another episode next week. Au revoir.
Cheers, guys.
Ciao.
Father, Lord, he's our Father, from our home.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.